The destructive capacity of a great wave can be calculated with some difficulty from a great mess of competing and combining features, including the configuration of the shoreline, the funneling effects of cliffs and headlands, and the depth of the coastal waters. It seems from the various eyewitness reports that what was most impressive about the waves that struck the shores of Java and Sumatra that morning was their sheer size. The high and unstoppable moving walls, the majestic volume of hundreds of billions of tons of roiling, thundering, foaming green water. The last four great explosions of Krakatoa's life took place at 5:30 a.m., 6:44 a.m., 8:20 a.m. and finally, and most terrifically of all, at 10:02 a.m., all of these well-chronicled moments being recorded in Krakatoa time, which, because the local Dutch administrators still each set their official watches according to when the sun rose and set and reached its noontime peak in their own districts, was in those days 5 minutes and 42 seconds behind what the capital's civil servants regarded as Batavia Standard Time. The energy that was released in these eruptions was transformed into a variety of violent effects. There were massive expulsions of rock and ash and gas. There were torrents of heat, searing and welding together everything around them. There were sounds, bangs, cracks, thunderous roars, shattering low and high-frequency noises that were so loud they could be heard thousands of miles away. Seismic shocks were triggered that caused buildings 500 miles away to rock on their foundations. And the eruptions also produced two kinds of shock waves. One was a wave that passed invisibly through the air, a sudden burst of pressure that bounced around the world and was recorded as doing so, moreover, a remarkable 7 times. These air waves, recorded as pressure spikes at the Batavia gasworks 90 miles to the east, radiated outwards from Krakatoa very fast, at what was an easily calculated velocity of about 675 miles an hour. They were recorded as reaching Batavia at 5:43 a.m., 6:57 a.m., and there seems curiously to be no firm record of any air wave resulting from the third explosion, at 10:15 a.m. respectively, Batavia Standard Time. These events took place, as we've said before, before the invention of time zones, either in the East Indies or anywhere else in the world. Taken together with the dubious accuracy of many of the mechanical clocks of the day, and the absence of the coordinating abilities of radio, which had, of course, not yet quite been invented, and the wide range of anecdotal reports from frequently panicky eyewitnesses, it makes it tricky, though not entirely impossible, to construct a firm chronology of what took place in the aftermath of the eruptions. The other shocks, considerably more complex in the way they moved, of much shorter duration but of equally extraordinary geographical spread, involved the disruption of the surrounding seawater. Seaborne waves in general move much more slowly, in the relatively shallow waters of the Sunda Strait, probably at an average speed of about 60 miles an hour. However the Krakatoa tsunamis were forged, it would take one of them about 30 minutes from the moment of eruption to travel to the closest point on the mainland, and it would be 37 minutes before the wave was close enough to the town of Anyer for the people there to see it, to recognise just what it was that was bearing down on them, and to start a fairly but not entirely futile gesture to try to outrun it. It would take a further 15 minutes for a great wave like this to seek out and destroy the quarries in Merak in the north and drown all the Chinese workers there, as it did. It would take 7 minutes fewer to flatten and wipe out all of Chiringing in the south, as it did also. And it would be 1 hour and 1 minute before the same wave, slowing itself down but building itself up in size all the while, would reach all the way up to the head of Lampong Bay and, as it was equally sure to do, to wreak havoc in the attractive little South Sumatran town of Telok Betong. The coastlines of Sumatra and Java are, like any coastlines, made hugely complex by all the inlets and island-shadowed estuaries, bays and peninsulas, rocks and reefs. The way that an inrushing wave behaves as it courses towards the shore is only vaguely understood, making it somewhat challenging to try to work out from the survivors' tales which wave actually struck and destroyed each affected town, village, kampong and home on the edges of the two great East Indian islands. Which wave was it that killed the vast majority of those 36,000 who were lost? Was it that low range of hills rising out of the sea that was seen, chillingly, by that elderly Dutch pilot in Anyer at dawn? The sight of those receding waters haunts me still, he was to write later, since for him this was the killer wave, without a doubt. As I clung to the palm tree, there floated past the dead bodies of many a friend and neighbour. Only a mere handful of the population escaped. Houses and trees were completely destroyed, and scarcely a trace remains of where the once busy, thriving town originally stood. Or was it the climax of all that terrible agitation of the sea that compelled Mrs. Byring across in Kettimbang to demand that her husband and family flee for the hills and the safety of high ground? Was it the giant black wall of water that roared into Telok Betong at 7:45 a.m., picked up the gunboat Barao as though it were a child's bathroom toy, and dropped it in the middle of the Chinese quarter of the town? The same wave that stranded the government's revenue cutter and smashed all the local prahus and scattered the fragments of their hulls about like so much confetti? Was it that one? Could it have been one of the four waves supposedly seen that morning by an engineer named R. A. Van Sandyk? He was a passenger aboard the Governor-General Loudoun, the steamer which, it will be remembered, was unable to dock at any of the quays in Lampong Bay because of the raging surf. The waves, which came in at tremendous speed sometime between 7:30 and 8:30 in the morning, destroyed all of Telok Betong before our eyes, he wrote. The light tower could be seen to tumble. The houses disappeared. The steamer Berau was lifted and got stuck, apparently at the height of the coconut trees, and everything had become sea in front of our eyes where a few minutes before Telok Betong Beach had been. The impressiveness of this scene is difficult to describe. The unexpectedness of what is seen and the tremendous dimensions of the destruction in front of one's eyes make it difficult to describe what has been viewed. The best comparison is a sudden change of scenery which in a fairy tale occurs by a fairy's magic wand, but on a colossal scale and with the conscious knowledge that it is reality and that thousands of people have perished in an indivisible moment, that destruction without equal has been wrought. Or was it again perhaps the wave which struck Merak at 9 a.m, the wave that drowned all but two of the town's 2,700 inhabitants? An accountant named Peschler, who somehow survived by running before it, climbing further and further uphill until he was beyond range, certainly would imagine this tsunami to be immeasurably vast. It destroyed stone buildings that stood on top of a hill later measured at 115 feet high. It drowned all 13 Europeans who lived there and who had had good reason to feel secure, surrounded as they were by walls of heavy masonry on the summit of a good high hill. But the wave displayed all the insouciance of its great power, and at the time it roared over, submerged and then wrecked these mansions, it was towering above them by a good 20 feet. Meaning that whether what Peschler saw was the wave or not, it was at least 135 feet high, formidable in its terror. It drowned everyone in the town below, and when the waters receded, almost everything in the town was either smashed beyond recognition or swept clear away. Or yet again, might the great wave have been the one that was recorded savaging Merak once more an hour later at 10:30 a.m, when a Dutch controller named Abel, on the road to Batavia with his Wadovo, an indigenous colonial official, to report to his superiors details of the tragic happenings yet further down the coast, looked round to see a colossal wave roaring up the shore. It was, he said later, taller than the tallest palm tree he could see, a wall of water that no one caught by it could possibly have survived, something so dreadful it was quite beyond nightmares. Might this have been the one? The answer on this occasion is probably yes. In fact, almost without a doubt, however compelling and awful the accounts of eyewitnesses to the other tsunamis of that dreadful morning may be, this last was indeed the one, the real killer wave. It happened at what seems to have been the correct time. With a travel speed of 60 miles an hour, its arrival at Merak at 10:30 would put its time of origin at Krakatoa at almost exactly 10 o'clock, which is at the moment of the culminating, self-destroying explosion. In addition, and most crucially, this one wave is recorded as having hit with extraordinary destructive power a short while either before or later than the Merak 10:30 a.m. arrival at all of the population centres of the West Java and South Sumatran coasts. An immense wave inundated the whole of the foreshores of Java and Sumatra bordering the Strait of Sunda, reported a contemporary study, and carried away the remaining portions of the towns of Chiringing, Merak and Telok Betong, as well as many other hamlets and villages near the shore. Its arrival was also recorded on the well-armoured tide meter in Batavia Harbour at 12:36 p.m. A wave so powerful as to give an almighty jolt to that tide recorder would have to be enormous indeed. It would also have had, if travelling at 60 miles an hour, to have begun its journey some 2.5 hours beforehand. This would have meant it had originated a few minutes past 10 in the morning. In other words, undoubtedly, from all the evidence, this too was Krakatoa's most colossal wave, the biggest consequence of the biggest and final explosion. It was a wave so enormous and so powerful that it turned out to be the grimmest of grim reapers, the terrible climax to a long and deadly day. "Everyone was frozen with horror," wrote the resident of Lampong, Mr. Altier, "of the moment when he heard the almighty explosion just after 10 on that Monday morning. He knew well from what had already happened, disastrously 3 or 4 times before during the previous 20 hours, just what to expect. Another tidal wave, probably much larger than before, since this was so great an explosion, would now come racing out from the island, and it would arrive within minutes. That is, of course, had there been an island. Mr. Altier had no means of knowing that Krakatoa was now no more, having just been blown to oblivion. In the event, the wave reached Telok Betong at 11:03. One anonymous European, writing some days later in a Batavia newspaper, the Java Bode, was down on the town's shore, helping the local people who had already had their houses wrecked by the morning's earlier onslaughts from the sea. He was just lifting a huge wooden beam from on top of a trapped man when he heard a scream. He looked up and saw a tall front of water rearing up and rushing towards him at a barely believable speed. There was a thunderous noise as it hit the beach and began rushing, crashing upwards through the town. At this point, the man's specific recollections become confused, his sudden panicked flight jumbling all conscious experience together into one amorphous mass. He is not alone in his confusion. The event must have been unforgettably dreadful, but in its details liable to the highly selective amnesia of those caught up by it. Each of those snared by the Telok Betong wave speaks first of running, wildly, panicked, trying madly to stay ahead of the wave, following natives running wildly too, of running, in the particular case of the anonymous European writing in the Java Bode, behind a woman who stumbled and dropped her baby and could not abandon it and so was swept away, of running behind another woman who was, somewhat incredibly it must be said, in the very process of delivery as she raced on, screaming and bloody, of seeing a man desperately trying to climb up as high as possible to avoid the wall of water by running up every slope that he found, of snatching hurried looks behind him to see, horrible in its immensity, the ever-pursuing wall which from time to time smashed against some obstacle and broke, disintegrating into equally huge and dirty grey piles of spray and wreckage-filled foam, but then regrouping and following him always with a roaring relentlessness, with an unstoppable energy, with a dogged and seemingly murderous resolution, such that he could only continue to run, despite being so leaden-legged and air-starved and exhausted, running ever onwards, always impelled by the frenzied gale that howled ahead of the wave, and by the certain knowledge that if he stopped or took a wrong turn that set him downhill rather than up, he would be brought down drowned and his body crushed and hurled against the broken walls and the jagged edges of spars and smashed glass and masonry that was rising up all around him. Any doubts about the power of this single awful wave would be dispelled later by the discovery of a single compelling piece of evidence, the position of the Dutch steam gunship, the Barrow. The brief fame of this doughty little craft, 4 guns, a draft of 6 feet, a 30-horsepower reciprocating steam engine, paddle wheels, and with a crew of 4 European officers and 24 native ratings, provides a singular measure of the ocean's ferocity. The captain of the Barrow had been the first to warn the mate of the Loudon that too strong a sea was running for him to risk a landing. That was at about 6 p.m. The Telok Betong harbourmaster then spotted her in difficulties about 5 hours later, in the middle of the night. She was well lit, and her plight was clearly visible through the gloom. Exceptionally strong waves were then breaking about her, and the official feared that not only might she break her mooring lines, but the heavy chains holding down the 2-ton conical steel mooring buoy to which she was attached might snap as well. Then, early next morning, disaster struck. There were 2 eyewitnesses, both the unnamed European in Telok Betong and the Loudon passenger, Mr. Sandik, saw her being lifted up on high by one of the 7:45 a.m. waves, then saw the mooring springs part one by one, saw the ship break free of her buoy and be transported high on the crest of a mighty wall of green water. She was swept westwards for a quarter of a mile until, as the wave broke, she was crashed down precipitously on the shore at the mouth of the Curipan River. It is thought that this fearful crash, in which the vessel remained upright, killed all of the crew. But it was not the end of the ship's own nightmare. When the great wave of 11:03 a.m. hit, the ship was picked up once again and carried westward a further 2 miles. She was driven all the way up the Curipan River Valley, along which the tsunami sped, and crashed down when the wave was spent about 60 feet above the level of the sea from which she had been plucked. She lay askew across the river, forming a bridge. She was upright once again, a macabre tomb for the 28 members of her crew. She was found and inspected the following month by the crew of a rescue ship. She lies almost completely intact, it was said. Only the front of the ship is twisted a little to port, the back of the ship a little to starboard. The engine room is full of mud and ash. The engines themselves were not damaged very much, but the flywheels were bent by the repeated shocks. It might just be possible to float her once again. But whether possible to float her or no, no one seemed ever interested in trying to slide her back all the way to the sea. This was no Fitzcarraldo. And so the Barrow remained where she was thrown, lying athwart the river for the better part of the next century, being picked apart by scavengers over the years like a carcass, or rotting quietly in the steam and sun. The hulk was more or less intact when it was visited in 1939. It was rusting and swathed in vines and had become home to a colony of monkeys. Pieces of her were last seen in the 1980s. Now she's all gone. The Curipan River trickles uninterrupted past where she lay, and the only memorial is her great mooring buoy, sitting on a plinth at the site where it was washed up, 2 miles from where it had last floated, and 50 feet higher than the level of the sea. The name Barrow is the Dutch word for remorse. The devastation in Sumatra was fully matched by that across the strait in Java. The tales from the survivors are every bit as memorable and dismaying. In the main towns, Anya especially, the ruination was near total. There were only momentary lapses into levity, a telegram received in Batavia reporting tersely, "Fish dizzy and caught with glee by natives," offering one of the very few light moments. For the rest, all was melancholy, and for the most melancholy memorial of all, a symbol of equivalent scale to the Barrow over on the far side, one need only to look at the great granite lighthouse at what was called Java's Fourth Point, a little way to the south of Anya. It survived the first onslaught, as had the gunship. It survived the wave that drove the Barrow up onto the beach, but when the wave that hit Telok Betong at 11:03 struck Anya, about 15 minutes earlier, since Anya is closer to the volcano, it picked up an immense piece of coral rock, weighing perhaps 600 tons, and dashed it against the column. Despite its cage of iron-reinforcing ribs, the light crashed down, extinguishing one of the most important navigation beacons of the entire Sunda Strait. And although his wife and child were drowned, the keeper himself survived. And with the phlegmatic way of both the well-trained lighthouse keeper and the fatalistic acceptance of a true Javanese, returned to his duties as soon as was physically possible, and had a temporary light erected and lit within a matter of hours. The stone stump of his lighthouse remains today, standing like an old and rotten tooth, rising no more than 10 feet above the ever-grinding waves of today's more peaceful sea. A replacement, built by the Dutch government 3 years after the eruption, stands close beside it, except that it has been constructed a prudent distance, probably about 100 feet, back from the shore, and it was constructed entirely of iron, just in case. The stump of the Fourth Point light remained, and the carcass of the paddle steamer gunship high in the river valley. But that was about all. The town of Anya did not survive, nor did Ketimbang, nor Telok Betong, nor Merak, nor Chiringing. The Anya Hotel, from whose veranda the first signs had been spotted weeks before, was no more than foundations and twisted banyan roots. The massive Dutch fort walls, which had survived the depredations of centuries, were cracked and tumbled into no more than shapeless masses of weathered stone. Railway tracks were twisted and scattered across the ground like so many yards of iron ribbon. Gear wheels and shards of broken iron and fractured lumps of machinery seemed to be everywhere. Giant boulders sat in entirely improbable places, picked up and smashed down as though they had been pebbles. Thousands upon thousands of houses and settlements up and down the coast of Java and Sumatra were ruined, flattened, everyone in or near them crushed or drowned, or never to be found again. And what also did not remain, and to everyone's astonishment was seen once the dust had cleared and the gloom had been swept from the sky to have totally vanished, was the volcano that had caused it all. Krakatoa, after the final majestic concatenation of seismic and tectonic climaxes that occurred just after 10 on that Monday morning, had simply and finally exploded herself out of existence. Lloyd's agent in Batavia, Mr. McColl, was able to send the following message within the week to his colleagues back in London, as concise a summary of the reality as that from his diplomatic colleague, Consul Cameron, down the road, and only a little less elegant. "We shall probably not be in possession," he wrote, "of full particulars for some days yet, as telegraph lines are damaged and roads destroyed, but so far we can give the following particulars. The island of Krakatoa, the summit of which peak was 2,600 feet above water level, has totally disappeared beneath the sea, and the neighbouring island of Dwysyndwy is split in 5 parts. 16 new volcanic islands have been formed between Krakatoa and Sibesi, and the sea bottom in the Strait of Sunda has completely changed. In fact, the Admiral Commanding-in-Chief has issued a circular stating that till new soundings have been taken, the navigation of the Strait of Sunda is likely to be extremely dangerous. Anya and Lighthouse and the other lights of southwest Java have all been destroyed. The subsidences and upheavals we have alluded to caused a large wave about 100 feet in height to sweep down on the southwest coast of Java and south of Sumatra. This was swept in for a great distance, thereby doing great injury both to life and property. We are here only 12 miles away from one of the points on which the wave spent its fury. The whole coastline to the southwest has changed its configuration. The inhabitants of the island of Onrust were only saved from the flood which swept over the island by taking refuge on board 2 steamers. At Merak government establishment, the inhabitants took refuge on a knoll 50 feet high, but were all swept off and drowned, with the exception of 1 European and 2 Malays who were saved. Mauk and Kramat, on the west side of the Batavia roads, have been laid waste and about 300 lives lost. In Chiringing, only 1 house has been left standing. Both the native and European officials have perished. A rain of mud also fell at the above place, which is situated opposite to where Krakatoa once lay. Anya seems to have been completely destroyed. Lloyd's sub-agent there wires from Serang, "All gone. Plenty lives lost." Part 3. The Experiences. Not much of great excitement seems ever to have happened on the island of Rodriguez, which in the late 19th century was one of Britain's more remotely idyllic tropical possessions. According to the 1881 census, some 5,000 people lived there, contentedly farming the 40 square miles of agreeable farmland and happily fishing the 200 miles of sandy coastline that had been set down, the relic of an old volcano itself, in a lonely corner of the western Indian Ocean. Mauritius, the notional mothership of which Rodriguez was then and still remains a dependency, lies 350 miles away to the west. There is a regular steamer service today and an occasional plane. In the latter part of the 19th century, there were infrequent supply calls by a chartered sailing vessel. A telegraph cable connecting the capital village of Port Maturin with the capital of Mauritius, Port Louis, wasn't built until the beginning of the 20th century. The people of Rodriguez, who were Creole-speaking and, according to a short book written in 1923 by a civil servant who claimed no pretense of fine writing, possessed of a deep brown velvety skin, hair of a very deep black, woolly and curly, protruding thick red lips and magnificent snow-white teeth, were descendants of slaves imported by the French to cultivate their sugar plantations. They had been left behind when the French were thrown out by the British at the end of the Napoleonic Wars. Their lives were run under the genial superintendency of the kind of quartet of British imperial administrators who might well have found their way into a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta: a magistrate, a medical officer, a chief of police, and a first-class priest. The latter paid an annual government stipend of 1,000 Mauritian rupees to remind the woolly-haired local people that God was most naturally an Englishman, and in this corner of the world, a Catholic Englishman to boot. Placidly unexciting though Rodriguez may have been through its 3 centuries of inhabited existence, it did make one appearance in the history books, courtesy of the volcano in the far-off East Indies. In August 1883, the chief of police on Rodriguez was a man named James Wallace, and in his official report of the dependency for the month, he noted, "On Sunday the 26th, the weather was stormy, with heavy rain and squalls. The wind was from the southeast, blowing with a force of 7 to 10, Beaufort scale. Several times during the night, 26th, 27th, reports were heard coming from the eastward, like the distant roar of heavy guns. These reports continued at intervals of between 3 and 4 hours, until 3 p.m. on the 27th, and the last two were heard in the directions of Oyster Bay and Port Mathury." This was not the roar of heavy guns, however. It was the sound of Krakatoa, busily destroying itself fully 2,968 miles away to the east. By hearing it that night and day, and by noting it down as any good public servant should, Chief Wallace was unknowingly making for himself 2 quite separate entries in the record books of the future. For Rodriguez Island was the place furthest from Krakatoa where its eruptions could be clearly heard. And the 2,968-mile span that separates Krakatoa and Rodriguez remains to this day the most prodigious distance recorded between where any unamplified and electrically unenhanced natural sound was ever heard and the place where that same sound originated. A popular Victorian science writer, Eugene Murray Aaron, explained to his readers why this figure of 2,968 miles should amaze them, one and all. If a man were to meet a resident of Philadelphia and tell him that he had heard an explosion in Trenton, 30 miles away, he might be believed, although there would be some doubts as to his powers of imagination. If, however, he should make the same assertion of an explosion in Wheeling, West Virginia, 300 miles away, all doubts of his accuracy would vanish. But if, with every sign of sincerity and a desire to be believed, he should earnestly insist upon his having heard an explosion in San Francisco, 3,000 miles away, he'd receive a pitying smile, and his listener would silently walk away. Yet just this last marvellous thing was true of those on the island of Rodriguez. It was heard in a score of other equally exotic places besides. No sound was heard in Rodriguez or anywhere else before the 26th, nor any after the night of the 27th, and there is general agreement among the usual welter of confusions, not the least of them caused by the same lack of time zones that frustrates attempts to make a chronology of the eruption and the sea waves, that the loudest sounds occurred everywhere in the middle of the day on the Monday, suggesting that they originated on Java some short while before noon. So, for example, the detonations were clearly heard in the early afternoon local time on what is now the notorious British-owned American base island of Diego Garcia. In those days it was also a Mauritian dependency, where local farmers pressed palm oil and made copra, and where there was a coaling station for steamers crossing the Indian Ocean. The plantation supervisors plainly heard the explosion while they were taking their lunch. "Nous avons cru tellement à l'appel d'un navire en détresse," they later reported. "We thought it was a ship in distress, firing its guns." There were scores of broadly similar reports. The explosions were heard in Saigon and Bangkok, Manila and Perth, and a lonely cable station south of Darwin called Daily Waters. From Port Blair, the capital of the Indian prison islands of the Andamans, came news that someone heard a sound as of a distant signal gun. No fewer than 18 different sets of witnesses in what was then Ceylon came forward with stories. Captain Walker and Mr. Fielder were puzzled at various times by hearing noises as if blasting was going on. Sounds as of firing a cannon at Trincomalee. Mr. Christie of the Public Works Department presumed some man-of-war was practising with her big guns out of sight of land, as he could see no ships. His Highness the Raja of Salwati Island in New Guinea said he had heard strange sounds and demanded of a local doctor why the white men were firing their cannons. Stockmen driving cattle across the Hammersley Range in Western Australia heard what they thought was artillery fire to the northwest. In Aceh, at the northern tip of Sumatra, the location then, as still today, of a fierce pro-independence rebellion, the Dutch garrison commander assumed a local fort had been blown up by insurgents and ordered all his men to battle stations. The Honourable Foley Vereker, who despite belonging to one of Ireland's leading military families had been cast out to the remoter colonies as commander of HMS Magpie off Banky Island near Borneo, recorded in his log how he and his crew all heard the sound. And close by them, those Dyak Islanders who had recently murdered a local official named Francis Whitty, and according to law had eaten his torso and limbs and had shrunk his head as a keepsake, heard the extraordinary sound too, assumed it to be the authorities coming to get them, and fled deep into the jungle. Ships were launched from scores of places by eager would-be rescuers and salvors, convinced there was an unseen vessel in trouble. A pair of fast ships set out from Makassar, for instance, because they assumed another was in dire straits. Two more set out from Singapore. A government boat went out in search off Timor, and when the sounds continued in Port Blair, the British authorities on the Andaman sent out a lifeboat too. In Singapore, it became impossible on one set of telephone lines to hear yourself speak, since a perfect roar as of a waterfall was heard, and by shouting at the top of one's voice, the clerk at the other end heard the voice, but not a single sentence was understood. The same noise was noticed on every line here. There was one aberrant report from a man named Foley on Cayman Brac, now a small nodule of highly expensive Caribbean real estate, but then a forlorn sliver of a tropical sandspit a day's sailing to the south of Cuba. Mr. Foley insisted that he heard the banging cannonades and that they happened in rapid succession on the Sunday. But there is neither corroboration nor a common-sense explanation. There was no eruption anywhere in the Caribbean at the time. It would be another 19 years before Montpellier exploded with classically Plinian intensity. And though freak atmospheric phenomena might be able to explain away this report of the explosion being heard 12,000 miles away, the fact that Mr. Foley also claimed to have heard it 12 hours before Krakatoa exploded suggests that his memory or his hearing was indeed at fault. Yet there were some oddities about the dissemination of the sounds, not the least being that a great number of people in Batavia and Buitenzorg and West Java generally heard nothing. Others simply felt strangely deaf or heard a curious buzzing in their ears, or else were aware of wild swings in the pressure all about them, as if they had been caught in some silent atmospheric hypertension. Experts in the field have taken many a stab at explaining why this might be. Some point out that the behaviour of sound waves in the upper and lower atmospheres is very different, and in the speeding up and slowing down that any wave experiences on passing through them, there may be a focus-like phenomenon brought into play which would make one locality receive a lot of sound and another very little. Others, less sophisticated, explain it by reminding us how snowfall muffles sound, and that ash falls, which covered Batavia and its suburbs at the time, are likely to do very much the same. Nevertheless, the overall conclusion remains inescapable, both to historical anecdote and to science. The sound that was generated by the explosion of Krakatoa was enormous, almost certainly the greatest sound ever experienced by man on the face of the earth. No man-made explosion certainly can begin to rival the sound of Krakatoa, not even those made at the height of the Cold War's atomic testing years. Those other volcanoes that have exploded catastrophically in the years since decibel meters were invented, Mount St. Helens, Pinatubo, Unzen, Mayon, haven't come close. No one suggests that the explosion of Mount St. Helens in May 1980 was heard much beyond the very mountain ranges in which it was sited. Dr. Verbeek, with the modest but assured prescience of one who had seen and heard and experienced the vastness of the eruption, stated in his report of 1885 that the exceptionally loud noises require our attention, the large explosions that in loudness have far exceeded all known noises. At no earlier event was a noise heard over such a large part of the Earth's surface. 13% of the Earth's surface vibrated audibly under the impact of Krakatoa's explosion, and millions who lived there heard it, and when told what it was, were amazed. The inaudible waves, it was soon discovered, had ventured even farther afield. The thousands of Europeans and Americans who noticed and recorded them, without in most cases ever realizing just what they were, did so all around the world at more or less the same time. The fact that they did so at all points up, quite unexpectedly, one of the newly formed habits of middle-class Victorian society, a set of habits that never anticipated such a catastrophe as Krakatoa, but nonetheless in due course took full advantage of its effects. The newfangled habits of the late 19th century included, among the time's multitudes of other scientific advances, the development of increasingly precise means for forecasting the weather. And while cost and complication limited popular access to most other sciences, it did become rapidly possible, and indeed rather popular, for people to buy and to use scientific instruments to help them understand the daily fluctuations in their climate. Consequently, as Victorian homes and clubs and hotels filled up their halls and vestibules with the ever newer and more handsome barometers, recording thermometers, and sun gauges and rain gauges, so the middle classes became an unwitting army of amateur meteorologists, faithfully tapping the glass each day, the better to predict whether it would be fine or stormy, changeable or fair. The most costly and sophisticated of these instruments, and because of its price reserved most commonly for the mantel shelf in the club, rather than the hall at home, was the recording barograph. The task of this small machine is to record, with an ink trace on a sheet of graph paper, secured around the circumference of a clockwork-driven drum, the small hourly variations in atmospheric pressure over the week that it takes for the drum to rotate a single time. A well-made barograph is a joy to behold, an elegant confection of brass and steel, mahogany and glass, its mechanicals visible inside its crystal case, its clockwork heart ticking away happily as it takes the pulse of the day. And the ink trace flowing gently up and down, sometimes more steeply downward if bad weather is on the way, arching up again if the storm passes over at speed, has a seductively sinuous beauty about it also. The records of the passing week's atmospheric alterations are stored in a small drawer under the instrument, to be studied later whenever the weather becomes the subject for reminiscence or chatter. One very noticeable aspect of a barograph's recorded trace is, however, just how smoothly the weather changes. The line invariably curves up or down slowly, steadily. It doesn't jump erratically like a seismic record during an earthquake or a lie detector revealing a falsehood. Atmospheric pressure, by contrast, changes with measured deliberation, a feature that the curves on the barograph reflect with their steady and considered moves across and along the ever-unrolling snake of recording paper. Except that, as scores of people around the world came to change their paper for the week that ended on Sunday the 2nd of September, 1883, and as they smoothed the records out to place them away in the drawer, they all, and almost simultaneously, noticed something. On the trace for the Monday of the week just gone, the 27th of August, there was a sudden and unanticipated jerk, a hiccup, a notch, an interruption, an altogether most puzzling thing. The pen that had been so smoothly and seamlessly noting the pressure on the instrument's vacuum chamber had suddenly been flicked up and then equally violently snapped down again. When looked at more closely, the oscillation was even more peculiar than that. First, there was a sudden recorded rise in pressure, then two or three minor oscillations, then a very deep depression, followed by a less steep rise, then more small oscillations, and finally, after an interruption that lasted for the better part of 2 hours, back to the smooth and gently changing trace of normal times. In summary, it seemed as though, and for some inexplicable reason, there had been the quite impossible occurrence of an earthquake in the air. It took only a matter of hours of excited discussion between observatories and weather-fascinated members of the lay public to draw the inescapable conclusion. This, far away though it may have been, was all Krakatoa's doing. As soon as the news of the extraordinary degree of the eruption had become widely known, it remained a simple matter to check the times of the strange 2-hour-long blips on the barograph traces, to make an allowance for the probable approximate speed of sound rate of travel of the shockwave, and to figure in the time difference between Krakatoa and the various club mantel shelves around the world. And lo, they all matched. The eruption that had sent out, as well as flame and ash and tidal waves and an incredible explosive sound, had also sent an invisible, inaudible shockwave, which passed cleanly through the atmosphere and had now been recorded, quite unexpectedly, on scores of machines designed for the much more prosaic task of suggesting to middle-class Victorian gentlemen in Birmingham and Boston and beyond whether or not they should take their umbrellas to luncheon. Except that it was, as is much that relates to Krakatoa's eruption, much more complicated than it seemed at first sight. For as the traces were examined more closely, and when they were compared with other barograph traces from more distant cities around Europe and then around the world, it appeared that the shockwave from Krakatoa's final cataclysmic explosion had travelled around the world not once, but seven times. The barographs and barometers and weather stations all recorded the signature two-hour wave, with the amplitude of oscillations diminishing at each pass, as it had apparently echoed, reverberated, and had flown back and forth and around the planet in a manner that seemed quite out of proportion to the magnitude of the original event itself. All of this provoked much fluttering in the scientific dovecots. Every weather expert in the world suddenly wanted to know what was going on, why a pressure wave like this would behave in this peculiar way. In scientific London, the degree of interest was particularly intense, and it prompted an entirely unanticipated response that despite Krakatoa being on Dutch sovereign territory, it would be best if it were to be left to a distinguished and entirely British body to investigate its eruption. This high-handedness, seen from today's perspective, quite boggles the mind. Perhaps it was the vast reach of British influence of the day that made this seem desirable to some. Perhaps, more specifically, it was the existence of all of those records from all of those British-owned and British-designed barographs. For all of those instruments, in places as far-flung as Melbourne and Mauritius in Bombay, turned out to have been made in England. Perhaps it was this that provoked this entirely unwarranted, but it has to be said, quite unresented, example of British imperial busybodiness. The timetable went like this. The explosion occurred in late August. In early September, the British barograph paper records, initially from the leather-bound and entirely masculine fastnesses of London clubland, but later from weather observatories at Greenwich, Kew, Stonyhurst, Glasgow, Aberdeen, Oxford and Falmouth, were changed and the blips were noticed. Suspecting that something of absorbing scientific interest was afoot, a senior British government official named Robert Scott, the secretary to the Meteorological Council, then promptly sent telegrams to his colleagues in observatories around Europe, asking if they would examine their traces too. And back came the reports, from Vienna and Berlin, Leipzig, Magdeburg, Rome, Paris, Brussels, Coimbra, Lisbon, Modena and Palermo, and other places besides, confirming in all respects what Mr. Scott suspected, that a wave of sudden pressure had swept around and around the planet from its birthplace in the Sunda Strait, that the passage of the wave had been a remarkable event, and that moreover it had lasted, echoing and reverberating around the globe, for no fewer than 15 days following the eruption. Mr. Scott found this extraordinary, and told his superior, an old India hand and engineer named General Richard Strachey. In December, only 4 months after the eruption, and so with quite unusual dispatch, the pair presented a brief paper to the Royal Society, that most estimable and ancient of British scientific institutions. It was entitled Notes on a Series of Barometrical Disturbances which Passed Over Europe Between the 27th and 31st of August, 1883. It caused an immediate sensation. And it did so because here was one of the first provable instances in which a natural event occurring in one corner of the planet had effects that spread over the entire world, or what would be the entire world if further records could be sought from the Americas and Asia and elsewhere, and which showed the same evidence. Here was the event that presaged all the debates that continue to this day about global warming, greenhouse gases, acid rain, ecological interdependence. Few in Victorian times had begun to think globally, even though exploration was proceeding apace, even though the previously unknown interiors of continents were being opened up for inspection, and even though the developing telegraph system, allowing people to communicate globally, was having its effects. Krakatoa, however, began to change all that. The world was now suddenly recognised as being much more than an immense collection of unrelated peoples and isolated happenings. It was, rather, an almost infinitely large association of interconnected individuals and perpetually intersecting events. Krakatoa, an event that intersected so much and affected so many, seemed all of a sudden to be an example of this newly recognised phenomenon. And so it was up to a British scientific society, most decidedly a British one, given the imperial mood of the day, like it or not, to investigate it. So a decision to do just this was taken in January, following the reading of two more short papers presented to the Royal Society, both describing the scene on the ground in and around the Sunda Strait. The first paper was by the British consul in Batavia, now a Mr. Kennedy from Sumatra, since Consul Cameron had, as we've mentioned, fallen ill, and the other by the socially well-connected Captain Vereker of HMS Magpie, who reported from Borneo. Both papers amply confirmed the view in London that this extraordinary event off Java had been so huge and so crucially world-affecting that a body had to be set up right away to investigate it. And so, on the 12th of February 1884, an advertisement, in the form of a letter to the editor, was placed in The Times. "The Krakatoa eruption," it said. "Sir, the Council of the Royal Society has appointed a committee for the purpose of collecting the various accounts of the volcanic eruption at Krakatoa and attendant phenomena, in such form as shall best provide for their preservation and promote their usefulness. The committee invite the communication of authenticated facts respecting the fall of pumice and dust, the position and extent of floating pumice, the date of exceptional quantities of pumice reaching various shores, observations of unusual disturbances of barometric pressure and of sea level, the presence of sulphurous vapours, the distances at which the explosions were heard, and exceptional effects of light and colour in the atmosphere. The committee will be glad to receive also copies of published papers, articles and letters bearing upon the subject. Correspondents are asked to be very particular in giving the date, exact time, stating whether Greenwich or local, and position whence all recorded facts were observed. The greatest practicable precision in all these respects is essential. All communications are to be addressed to your obedient servant, G.J. Simmons, Chairman, Krakatoa Committee, Royal Society, Burlington House." It took 5 years for what at first might have seemed a somewhat pumice-obsessed committee to study all of the complex and new types of information that then flowed from the event. And their final report, issued in 1888, and with its 494 pages of text and countless drawings, graphs and exquisite coloured prints, standing as a lasting masterpiece of determined study, elegantly composed style and splendid Victorian brio, collated, among other things, all of the pressure wave observations that had led to the establishment of the committee in the first place. And what was found out about them was simple but remarkably beautiful, that the shock waves from Krakatoa had radiated across the world like ripples on the surface of a pond, a surface of the vast and slightly flattened sphere, in the case of the Earth, of course, rather than the merely circular surface one would find on a pond. They had radiated outwards at a speed approximating that of audible sound of between 674 and 726 miles per hour. The waves had travelled outwards, expanding their width until they were halfway to their goal, and then contracting again until they reached their precise antipode, which in the case of Krakatoa, which is at 6 degrees 6 minutes south, 105 degrees 25 minutes east, is a point at 6 degrees 6 minutes north, 105.25 west, in the Pacific Ocean off Bogota, Colombia. Then, having taken 19 hours to reach this nameless and watery antipode, they headed off back again and returned to Krakatoa, the passage being noted on all the barographs in between at a bewildering variety of places that included St. Petersburg, Toronto, the Antarctic island of South Georgia, and a village that is now a pretty New York suburb called Hastings-on-Hudson. Every time the wave was noticed, so the time of its passing agreed with the eruption time that had been noted by observers back in the Sunda Strait. The wave's passage above the Greenwich Observatory, for example, was recorded on all the barograph's registers, with the sharp upward tick of pressure, the minor ruffles on the record, the sudden downward blip, further ripples, the slow upwards rise to the resumption of normal state, at 1:23 p.m. on the Monday. Krakatoa time was 7 hours ahead of London, meaning that at 10:02 a.m, the local time when the volcano exploded, it was 3:02 a.m. in Greenwich. Subtracting that from the time that the observatory barographs recorded the blip gives a figure for the wave's travel time of 10 hours, 21 minutes, the precise figure that could be calculated for inaudible shock waves moving across the 7,220 miles of a great circle separating London from Java. And as the Greenwich Observatory corroborated the figures, and as it did so for the 6 further passes of the shock as it moved back and forth across the capital before it had weakened to the point where it could no longer be detected, so 2 things became even more clear: that the eruption time was exactly right, 10:02 a.m, and that the world now knew a great deal more about the transmission of atmospheric shockwaves than ever before. Meteorology in general profited mightily from the findings, and in the mid-20th century, when large atmospheric explosive tests were conducted during the Cold War, the way in which shockwaves were propagated through the atmosphere was well understood also. The Krakatoa Committee had, even if only in these respects, fully justified its existence. The tsunamis that killed so many on the shores of Java and Sumatra crossed the world as well. It was, of course, clear from the beginning that up close to the volcano, the waves were enormous and they killed thousands. That they then became ever smaller in proportion to their distance from Krakatoa was to be expected. But the discovery that they were in fact so deeply powerful and radiated away from the volcano so aggressively that they could still be detected in the sea as far away as the English Channel was the cause of general astonishment. The first to receive firm news of the appearance of some faraway Krakatoa-induced wave was Charles Darwin's son George, shortly after he was elected, by the narrowest of votes, the Professor of Astronomy at Cambridge. His friend, Major A.W. Baird, who had the post of Chief of the Tidal Survey of India, wrote to him in Cambridge to say that the wave caused by the volcanic eruption at Java is distinctly traceable on all the tidal diagrams hitherto received, and I am informed of a great tidal disturbance at Aden on August the 27th. But the daily reports from there are always meagre in information. Karachi and Bombay also show the disturbance, and as far as I have examined, the wave reached halfway up to Calcutta on the Hooghly. This last, the news that waters had rushed up the Hooghly River almost to the city that was then the capital of British India, did it. The Royal Society promptly asked for an immediate report. Major Baird swiftly obliged with a 6-page summary of what he could tell from his survey station's reports from across that immense swathe of imperial territory that stretched between Aden and Rangoon. And the Krakatoa Committee, recognising a significance that went beyond the simple threat to Calcutta, immediately commissioned a senior Royal Navy captain to investigate the phenomenon worldwide. Records from tide gauges at ports all across the world were speedily gathered in. An early analysis showed a fascinating but not entirely unanticipated trend, that almost all of the stations that recorded sudden and unexpected waves that could be positively linked to the eruption, by their timing and their type, lay to the west and the south of the island. Almost all, though not Batavia herself, which lies 83 miles away to the east as the crow flies, and considerably further so far as a tidal wave might pass. Despite where she lay, the capital city did indeed witness what even the Royal Society saw fit to call a wall of water when the wave hit her gauge at 12:36 p.m. on the Monday afternoon, 2 hours and 32 minutes after the explosion. According to the Reverend Neal, the water rushed into the Batavian canal system, rising suddenly by several feet, forcing hundreds of merchants and residents to flee for their lives. The day, unusually cold, half dark and drab, the air still filled with grey, gritty ash that got into their hair and their eyes and their teeth, had begun with, surprisingly, a fair sense of stoic normality. The steam trams were filled with people setting off for work, the markets were thronged, the private horse-drawn carriages were trotting around the Königsplein, their occupants talking excitedly about the events of the night before, confident that the worst was over. Then came the arrival of what was swiftly understood to be the huge relic of the great tsunami, the remains of a wave that somewhere had been much, much worse, and it made all these good burghers of Batavia realise, and very swiftly, that in fact the worst was still to come. The maximum height of this bore, the needle on the Batavia tide meter shot up vertically, clear off the scale, was at least 7 feet 6 inches, a fraction of the height of the devastating waves that destroyed Anyer and Telok Betong, maybe, but an impressive enough display. The waters then promptly fell back again to 10 feet below normal sea level, and then rose back up again, then sloshed back down, oscillating a total of 14 times. Over the next 28.5 hours, the height of the successive waves diminishing all the while, until finally, after what was no more than a 3-inch ripple, hit the Batavia tide meter at 5 minutes past 5 on the afternoon of the next day, the Tuesday, they vanished clear away. But Batavia was essentially alone in the area to experience the great wave. Almost no other places to the north and east of the volcano experienced anything at all. Singapore's tide meters registered nothing, nor was there any discernible blip in the records of Hong Kong, Yokohama or Shanghai. And even at Surabaya, at the eastern end of Java, the disturbance that was picked up on the port's 3 tide gauges was only 10 inches, too insignificant to be otherwise noticed. There's a very simple reason for the lack of any dramatic effects on this side of the volcano, as a glance at any map will show. To the east of Krakatoa, the 2 sides of the Sunda Strait pinch inwards like the jaws of a nutcracker. There are islands blocking the way too, Thwart the Way Island being one such, notorious in its nuisance value, and before any wave has any chance of reaching Batavia Port herself, there are long fingers of shallows and sandbanks and further islets and reefs, all of them conspiring to slow down and frustrate the eastward movement of any wave. Nothing would stand in the way of a sound wave or a shock wave, but faced with the dissipating influence of the shoals and headlands, a water wave would essentially not move eastwards at all, as the recorders everywhere confirm. However, to the west of Krakatoa, except for the presence of a small headland called Vlakohuk in southern Sumatra that acts as a small chicane on a westbound wave's right-hand side, there's only the wide-open sea of the Indian Ocean. Any tsunami moving out from the eruption in this direction would be free to go wheresoever it wished, without maritime hindrance or interruption. And in August 1883, the great 10 o'clock wave did indeed fan out westward entirely untrammelled and managed to go just about anywhere and everywhere it wanted. 2 types of waves were detected, what were called long waves, which reverberated back and forth at periods of as much as 2 hours, and the short waves, which were steeper and with a much less regular and more frequent repeat. The old Dutch port of Gaul, close to the southern tip of the island of Ceylon, is where the arrival of these short waves, or more precisely a sequence of 14 waves, each of them separated by just a few minutes, was first noticed. The Ceylon Observer correspondent filed on the 27th of August that an extraordinary occurrence was witnessed at the wharf at about 1:30 p.m. today. The sea receded as far as the landing stage on the jetty. The boats and canoes moored along the shore were left high and dry for about 3 minutes. A great number of prawns and fishes were taken up by the coolies and stragglers about the place before the water returned. A woman was killed at the port of Panama, still in Ceylon, not on the isthmus, when she was swept from the harbour bar by an immense influx of water. Both the Panama harbour master and the local ruler, the splendidly titled Rata Mahatmaya, said later that ships had suddenly sunk downwards and were then drawn backwards, to be left stuck in the drying mud, their anchors exposed, and just as suddenly were borne up by an inrushing surge of water. The local streams with hitherto sweet water all promptly turned salty for at least 1.5 miles upriver. The woman who died from the injuries she sustained in falling while she was carrying a sheaf of paddy from the fields is thought to have been the most distant casualty of the eruption, nearly 2,000 miles away. At Hambantota, further south still, Ceylon government officials estimated the wave at 12 feet high and said that, like at Panama, its currents were irresistible, taking small craft back out to sea and then sweeping them back and dashing them to pieces on shore. But however violent, there were no casualties here, nor any further afield. The long waves tend to be the ones that were recorded by the automatic tide gauges around the world, and it is these that make up the bulk of the formal record. The short waves tended to be more the stuff of anecdote, and because they oscillated so swiftly, rarely made an appearance on the recorders. By the time the long waves reached India, they were diminishing fast. 14 inches high in Madras, a series of 10 or so 6 inches at Calcutta, a foot high in Karachi, half that in Aden. They spread southwestwards towards the African coast as well. They broke a hawser of a boat moored in Port Louis, Mauritius, and in the rarely visited Indian Ocean reef harbour known as Cargados Carayos, the captain of the Evelina reported huge, smooth oscillations in the sea, breaking only when they came into contact with coral heads. Already, the wave was 2,662 miles from its point of origin and racing steadily along at a calculated 370 miles each hour. A 4-foot-high wave was noted at Port Elizabeth on the bleak and generally unlit east coast of South Africa, and undulations were picked up at Cape Town and, by a visiting German South Polar Expedition, which failed to reach its goal, on the island of South Georgia, where the icebergs and the brash in the harbour of the whaling station at Grytviken were lifted 15 inches in a series of a dozen recorded and remarkable swells. And so the waters progressed ever outwards, with numerous waves of different types and styles, heights and frequencies, and deriving from what oceanographers now reckon were a number of different causes, too. Eventually, they ran out of steam and reached as far as they could go in the further recesses of northwestern Europe. By the time they reached the North Atlantic and then the Bay of Biscay, the oscillations were small indeed, such that the tide diagrams had to be photographed and blown up in order to be able to measure the fluctuations in the record. But they're there all right, tiny but still distinct. In Sokoa, a tiny French harbour near the more celebrated resort of Biarritz, and 10,729 sea miles from Krakatoa, there were 7 undulations, each of them 3 inches high, barely enough to be noticed by promenaders on the beach, though I like to fancy pomaded young men and their lady friends skipping amusingly out of the way when the unusual small swells suddenly threatened their boots and their turnips. Further north, at Rochefort, a town on the Charente, a little north of the Gironde and Bordeaux, the magnifying power of the estuary pushed the waves up to 5 inches high. They had sped there from the volcano at a calculated and now slightly faster rate of 414 miles per hour, barely slowing as they did so. And finally, turning the corner into the English Channel, the slightest trace only is noticeable. There's a ripple recorded at Cherbourg, another at Le Havre, and an irregular but discernible series of undulations at Devonport, close to where all Royal Navy cadets are now trained to be officers. But closer in, at Portland, Plymouth and Dover, nothing. Maybe there's just the vaguest of signs of it on the gauge on the inner side of the Portland breakwater, though the indications of disturbance, admits the Royal Society report, are not very conclusive, as no regularity of period is traceable in the small indentations which do appear. I confess I would have derived no small pleasure from discovering that on the Tuesday morning, when the waves were seen in France and in the English West Country, the tide gauge in Dover Port also suddenly startled its keeper with a splash or a slop or a curious and inexplicable swell. But no such luck. With Dover being no less than 11,800 sea miles from the Sunda Strait and lying at the distant end of a channel in which the water shallows to a few hundred feet and less, and which would kill or dampen the kind of long sea waves that were produced by the eruption, it is perhaps not surprising to learn that the gauges here showed no deflection at all. The air wave may have found its way to Greenwich 7 times, but the sea wave was brought up short, 500 miles from home, and it never arrived near the British capital, even once. Yet other quite different effects of the eruption were before long visible in London and New York and other northern capitals, and many of them were aesthetically and dramatically quite memorable. Art was born out of the after-effects of this volcano, art that was then quite unexpected and, though not so popular today, is not quite yet forgotten. For the millions of tons of dust that were hurled into the upper air in the East Indies disseminated themselves around the world for the next many years, and they caused all manner of extraordinary phenomena, not the least of them being sunsets, which were seen all over the world decked out in the most lurid rainbows of colours, and which attracted the interest of a score of suddenly excited painters. One of the more prominent of these was Frederick Edwin Church, a member of what came to be known as the Hudson River School of American 19th-century landscape painters. he turned out to be precisely the kind of artist who would benefit from the atmospheric consequences of faraway Krakatoa. Frederick Church specialised in highly dramatic landscapes and highly coloured skyscapes. He had a predilection for the grand. His gigantic Niagara presents a quite astonishing image of the raw power of falling water, and the excessively radiant, his Twilight in the Wilderness, has an unforgettable richness about its evening colour. Both of these artistic preferences came together in December 1883 when Church, supposedly well aware of the remarkable effects of Krakatoa's spreading trail of dust on the world's sunsets, travelled north from his ornate Moorish castle in the riverside town of Hudson to the very tip of upstate New York on the Canadian border. There he would try to capture an image of what he suspected would be an especially livid northern twilight. He chose Chaumont Bay at the very eastern end of Lake Ontario. The early winter ice would be piling up in the westerly winds. There would be newly undraped trees on the wispy peninsulas, and above all there would be the vast expanse of the lake into which the setting sun would appear to sink. He chose to render the image in watercolour. The resulting picture, not surprisingly called Sunset Over the Ice on Chaumont Bay, Lake Ontario, has a range of colours in the sky, a gently intermingling play of pinks and mauves and orange and salmon and purple that are quite astonishing and unusual and suggestive of something happening, something inexplicable, high in the evening atmosphere. It's the only major painting to be created in the immediate aftermath of Krakatoa, and even if Church had not set out with the deliberate intention of making post-eruptive art, the piece stands now as vivid documentary testimony to the giant volcano's effects. Lesser artists had a field day. The most notable of them was William Ascroft, who lived beside the River Thames in Chelsea, and who noticed early in September, 2 weeks after the eruption, that London was suddenly being gifted with a series of memorably setting suns and, more interesting, unusually strong afterglows. He painted them at a furious rate, creating a total of no fewer than 533 watercolours over the months of his fascination. On especially gorgeous evenings, he might make several paintings, one every few minutes, creating as he did so a kind of time-lapse image of the entire process. On the 26th of November, for example, he painted the aftermath of the sun's disappearance once every 10 minutes, between 4:10 p.m. and 5:15 p.m, catching a sequence of fiery purples and oranges with all the fleet-footed accuracy of a film camera. He wrote lengthy notes and analyses of what he saw, blood afterglows and amber afterglows among them, and examples of the beaming coronas that often surrounded the setting sun itself, and which were named after the Hawaiian naturalist who first spotted them, Bishop's Rings. All 500 of his paintings later went on show at an exhibition in a museum in South Kensington. They remain today inside what is now the Natural History Museum, locked away and half forgotten. Dust of all grades and compositions was thrown into the air by the eruption. Much of it, too heavy to be kept on high for long, fell down as drifting veils of grey and was widely reported as having done so. Ships at sea experienced dust falls for a fortnight after the eruption. The Brani and the British Empire, for instance, came under a slow rain of a white ash that one master said looked like Portland cement when they were sailing in the Indian Ocean within a 2,000-mile range of the volcano. The Scotia experienced falling dust until the 8th of September when she was off the Horn of Africa, 3,700 miles away. But the lighter material, the finest particles of all, were thrown up right through the troposphere until, almost defying the pull of gravity, they were caught up for months in the lower reaches of the stratosphere itself. Modern estimates suggest the Krakatoa eruption hurled material at least 120,000 feet up into the air, some say 160,000 feet or 30 miles. Tests have since shown that up so high, material can hover in a kind of weightless stasis. A dust particle with a diameter of a micron, whether it is an aerosol droplet or a tiny fragment of volcanic silicate material, really makes no difference, has recently been shown to take many weeks to descend vertically through just half a mile of stratosphere. A particle of half a micron in diameter will take many months, so slight is the tug of gravity upon it. Yet horizontal movement was apparently no problem for the Krakatoa material. The strong globe-circling winds of those altitudes spread them far and wide. and the rains that would tend to flush out any particles that might have been tempted to stay in the lower reaches were, of course, non-existent up high. And so they stayed put, undisturbed, for very, very long periods. And by refracting and filtering, and in a myriad other ways altering so vividly the colours of the sunlight that passed by them, and staining the crepuscular skies with vermilions and passion fruits and carmines and royal mauves, so they ensured more potently than any other effects that Krakatoa would soon become the most famous volcano in world history. Not only did Krakatoa kill more people than any eruption, and for that it remains notorious, but it became much more widely known to hundreds of millions of people around the world for the more benign and beautiful of reasons, and that all could readily see for themselves each time they looked westwards at eventide. The poets were inspired in much the same way as were the painters. Alfred Lord Tennyson is widely believed to have been thinking of Krakatoa when, 9 years after the eruption, in his almost wholly forgotten poem St. Telemachus, he wondered out loud, "Had the fierce ashes of some fiery peak been hurled so high they ranged about the globe? For day by day, through many a blood-red eve, the wrathful sunset glare."